All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And this is Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. Welcome to our program. We've got a really crammed full episode for you today here on Veterans Radio. We're going to be starting off by talking to a representative from Camp Liberty here in Michigan, and they've got a fundraiser coming up, so we're going to be talking with them. Then we've got a segment all about Operation Song, and we've got two women that are going to be talking about that. And you know, Operation Song pairs up a veteran with a songwriter. Stick around for that. I think you'll really enjoy this very powerful song. And then later on, we've got a little segment on from NVBDC. Jim Falzone's going to be talking with Keith King about what's going on with our favorite sponsor, NVBDC. And then finally, the last portion of the program is a little bit of a replay from 2006. And Bob Gould and I interviewed a Len Lamel, who was participated in the D-Day invasion of Europe in June of 1944. And I think you're going to really like that. That's our tribute to the anniversary of D-Day coming up this week. So before I get into all of that, we've got to thank our sponsors. That's Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. Give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of a veteran-owned business. For more information, go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to thank our long local veterans organizations for their continuing support. That's the Irwin Press Corps and American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. We can't do this program without the support of these folks, and we need your support. Hey, just to let you know, we are coming up on our 1,000th program on July 9th. So make sure that you tune in on July 9th. It's going to be a lot of great fun. We're going to have a lot of people that have been on the program in the past. Maybe you'll be on it. And we're also going to be celebrating this on July 9th and the outside of the studios of WAAM here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So stick around for more information on that. Go to our website, veteransradio.org now, because we finally got the transition going where we've gone from a .net to a .org, because Veterans Radio is a nonprofit 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and you can feel free to donate if you would like to help us keep our stories going on the air for the next 1,000 episodes. So cool, right? All right, we're going to take right into our first segment, and this is Larry Antoine from the Camp Liberty talking about their upcoming event. As you know, here on Veterans Radio, every week we like to talk about a different veterans organization out there that's designed to help veterans. And we have one locally here in the Ann Arbor area, and it's called Camp Liberty. And joining me on the line right now is one of their directors, Larry St. Antoine. And Larry, tell us what's going on out at Camp Liberty.
This is our first get-together for Camp Liberty, and it's going to take place out in Brooklyn, Michigan. The address is 7044 Kepler Drive, Brooklyn, Michigan. And we're going to have a classic car and motorcycle show. It will be running. It's Saturday, June 24th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we're asking anybody with a classic car or motorcycle, if you could show up around 8:30, we'll get you in. We're asking for a donation of $20 per adult, which would include barbecue lunch, live music, silent auctions. And we have 138 acres of land out there along with our hunting area that we have veterans come out to. We will give tours, and we have awards for the best classic car and best classic motorcycle.
Cool. So it's $20 for everybody who, well, it's not $20. It's a donation, correct?
Well, yeah, this is our yearly event to be able to make money to keep the veterans hunting seasons open there and other things that we have.
Yeah, I know you have a lot of activities out there at Camp Liberty, and your motto is building a stronger veteran community. And you guys do all kinds of things. Most of these things are for disabled veterans. I know that you provide hunting opportunities, and you have vehicles that allow, you know, veterans that are confined to wheelchairs and stuff to get out and hunt and all kinds of things, don't you?
Yeah, we have 3 track wheelchairs that they're able to use. Last year we had 4 deer hunts, and we had a total of, I think it was about 20 vets that came out deer hunting, and they all had a great time and a lot of comrade, you know, together. And mm-hmm. this year we expanded it to a turkey hunt and a pheasant hunt. And then other than the 4 deer hunts that we have.
Cool. And were people able to get their legal limit?
Oh, yeah. Well, with the pheasant hunt, we work with a local pheasant organization. And we spend about $850 to have the pheasants brought out.
Oh.
we have our own turkeys here. So
well, yeah,
both of them were very successful. And we're looking forward to our 4 deer hunts that are coming up.
That's cool. I think that's really cool. So we're talking with Larry San Antoine. He's one of the directors of Camp Liberty. They've got a car and bike show coming up on Saturday, June 24th, running from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. They are located out at 7044 Kapler Drive in Brooklyn, Michigan. Zip is 49230. For those of you who want to set your GPS, it's about 7 miles west of Manchester, Michigan, off of Austin Road. If I have a motorcycle or a car that I want to bring out, do I just bring it, or should I contact somebody?
Your listeners can go to CampLibertyMichigan.org. That's online, mm-hmm. and it gives all the information. And if they also just want to donate, we have a donation set up there online, too.
That's cool. All right, Larry, thank you very much. Larry San Antoine from the CampLibertyMichigan.org. Help these people out. They're doing a great job out there letting people go hunting. So, Larry, thanks very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I hope to see you out there on the 24th.
We appreciate it, Dale. Thank you very much for what you do.
I encourage you to go to CampLibertyMichigan.org and find out more about this terrific organization. It's a great place for veterans to go and just relax and feel comfortable in the great outdoors. Coming up right now is our next segment, and this is the Operation Song portion of the program, and this includes a woman veteran and a woman songwriter, and they collaborated on a song called Rise. I think you're going to really enjoy this. So here we go to Operation Song. All right, we are back here on Veterans Radio, and our segment on Operation Song this month is talking about 2 women that got together at the Nashville VA Women's Clinic as part of their Operation Song program there in April, it looks like. And so I wanted to bring them on and talk to you about. Remember, Operation Song is usually it pairs up a veteran with a songwriter, and they, so far, the ones I have heard, they put together these just wonderful songs, and it's a way of helping the veteran kind of get their stories out, because, you know, sometimes many of us have difficulty talking about our experiences, whether they're in the military or out of the military, and this is a great way that Operation Song has, you know, put this idea together, and I don't know, it just seems to work. So joining me on the program today, our veteran is Christy Alderson, and our songwriter is Jen Franklin. I'm going to start off with Christy first. So Christy, welcome to Veterans Radio, first of all.
Hi, thank you, Dale.
And then tell me what branch of their service you were in and what was your job?
So I was in the Navy. I was actually an aviation electronics technician, an AT, and I was stationed in California. I was on a Marine base, MCAS El Toro, attached to VMFAT 101.
Okay, for those of us that were not in the Navy, we don't know what that means, but but it means he was in California. And
yes.
Sounds like and you worked with avionics?
I did. So I actually worked on the F-18. Okay. And our division worked on the navigation radar and communication system.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you still in the service, or have you gotten out?
I am no longer in the service. I got out. I served from 1994 to 98. And right now I'm an entrepreneur. So I do hair. I have my own salon. And I just launched a eco-friendly product line for the hair and skin. So that's what I'm working on now.
Okay. Good for you. Good for you. I think that's terrific. Mm-hmm. So let me bring on Jen Franklin. Jen is a songwriter, a well-known songwriter in the Nashville area and around the country, I believe. I was looking up your information on your website, Jen, and saw that you've written a lot of great songs over the time, and I'm becoming a fan after listening to some of them.
And, thank you.
So we can go from there. So, Jen, how did you get involved with Operation Song?
Yeah, you know, I got pulled into this by another songwriter who was doing one of the, I think it was the very first women's retreat that they were holding with Operation Song, and I was very hesitant to do it. I thought, oh, I don't know if that's really my thing. That seems like that might be kind of a scary thing to get into, but I just decided, oh, you know what? I'll go try it once. What is the worst that can happen? And it was probably one of the most amazing songwriting experiences I've ever had. And then I've been doing that pretty much every year for the past 10, going on 11 years now. So yeah, I love it.
And so how did you get hooked up with Christy?
Well, Christy and I got paired up. They usually do kind of figure out the pairings before we have these retreats. And I guess they just decided that maybe the type of music I like to do might be a good fit for her. It's kind of hard to say how they make those selections, but I was really, really excited once I got a chance to talk with her. She's just a very cool, very powerful woman. And I like to write empowered kind of songs. So it was just, it felt like such a good fit. I was like, all right. I was kind of tired that day. I had a lot going on. I was like, okay, I got to do another one of these. But once I talked to her, I had so much energy. I was just ready to go.
And Christy, how did you volunteer for this? Let's put it that way. I was going to say got drafted, but that's an old term. That's a term I used when I was in. How did you get involved?
Actually, it was through my therapist. It's a program that they offer to their clients. And so when she told me about it, I was like, okay, that sounds interesting. I really didn't know what to expect. But when they paired us together, me and Jen, I was like so excited. She's so sweet. She is amazing. And she got my words together and created a beautiful masterpiece. I'm so thankful, Jen.
Oh, Christy. And Christy had a lot of great words. She gave me a lot to work with, which is just wonderful. And I'm able to use the person's own language. I just think that has so much more power than if I were to write it, more myself. So it was great. She gave me a lot to work with.
When you put these songs together, do you sit down with each other and just kind of, Jen, do you ask questions
Yes. Okay. I actually have a whole process where I have a notebook that I write a whole lot of notes and ask lots of questions and kind of try to get as much information as I can on the front end. And then I start kind of fiddling around the song. And then I check in with Christy at a certain point, be like, okay, what do you think? Is this kind of going in a good direction? What should we do with maybe the next verse? So just kind of doing it that way really worked well. And we did this over Zoom. So we did have to kind of call each other back and forth. We were taking some breaks in between to work on the music.
So did you come up with the melody first or the lyrics first?
Well, the lyrics were definitely a driving factor to start with it. And that's true for a lot of these songs, just because there's so much of a story that I'm getting ready to tell. But melody is something that I just adore as a songwriter. And I feel like it comes pretty quickly for me most of the time if I'm inspired by what I'm writing. And I really was that day. I was just kind of on fire. So it came really fast.
And Christy, how about you? Have you ever been involved in writing a song before?
Never been involved with songwriting. Love music, all types of genres. And I was just amazed how quickly she was able to, take my story and put it together in a song. It's very amazing. Songwriters are very gifted.
I think they are. They are true artists.
Yes, they are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the song. The title is called Rise, and I guess I'll let whoever wishes to talk about it, how you came up with this kind of theme for a rise? What were we rising from?
You want to go, Chrissy?
I'll begin. So the song is about what I experienced in my marriage. I got married at a very young age, and just going through the process of the divorce and all the things that I went through to get to a divorce and raising my kids, like, it's about triumph. It's about succeeding. It's about pain. It's all those elements that I actually went through and recovered from.
The lyrics are great, and what I would like to do for both of you right now is play the song. That is awesome. That is
that was so amazing.
So powerful. So powerful. Yes, I mean, it just has to, Chrissy, it just has to lift you up or rise, as it says.
Oh, it does. It does. It brings tears to my eyes every time I hear it. But I love that song. It's amazing.
I am so pleased and proud to be able to introduce it to the world and let them know that this is what Operation Song does. And, that they work together, and all of these things that are inside of you are able to come out, and comes out in just a beautiful song. Beautiful song. Holy cavoli. Both of you are just so talented.
She did a great job with it. She really did. She did such a good job being open. Some people have a harder time with that than others. I've had a couple of people that got reined in and were not really excited to be there. So I've sometimes had my work cut out for me, but we still get songs. So it's such an amazing process when someone is open as Christy was for that day.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
I can understand that. And it's been a pleasure for me to speak with both of you today here on Veterans Radio. Yeah. And I hope that we'll find out more about you. If you make, if you produce more songs, God, I'd love to hear them. And again, I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
Okay. I thought that was a great song. That is just a great song. Can't tell you, I really appreciate that. All right, we're going to go into our next is up. Coming up is our interview with Keith King from NVBDC that Jim Falsone held a couple of days ago. So here we go, NVBDC. After NVBDC, actually, we're going to be playing our Medal of Honor segment, and we're going to come right out of our Medal of Honor segment and go to the final segment of our program today, and that is going to be our interview from 2006 with Lem Lamel. Lem was as I say, a World War II veteran. He participated in D-Day. This program is from 2006. Unfortunately, Lem passed away in 2011. So here we go. NVBDC with Jim Falsone, straight in to the final segment of the program.
Welcome. I am Jim Falsone, and this is Veterans Radio's Spotlight on National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC. We have a long-standing partnership with NVBDC, which is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses of all sizes. It's a 501c3 nonprofit established in 2013, I should say. And we're glad to have on with us today, again, the founder and main guru, CEO of NVBDC, Keith King. Keith, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to be back, and I haven't been called a guru since the 60s. So, okay, I'll work with it.
We're aging, both of us here. So, but there's a lot of interesting things going on with NVBDC and how it's changing how American businesses perceive veteran-owned companies. And I think really the proof of the concept will be the news you have on the billion-dollar roundtable numbers. But why don't you start with explaining what the billion-dollar roundtable is and how it relates to NVBDC.
Thank you, Jim. The billion-dollar roundtable is comprised of corporations that literally spend $1 billion per year with the supplier diversity programs, primarily counting the minority, the women, the veterans, and the gay and lesbian, and now disabled as well. But this group has grown to 32 corporations now. And when I started with them, there were 17, 18. But anyways, 28 of those 32 are, in fact, NVBDC corporate members. So obviously we're very tightly aligned with the members of the billion-dollar roundtable. And what is significant?
And let me interrupt for folks who don't, this is foreign territory to them when they hear billion-dollar roundtable. These are guys like Ford, Amazon. Give us some other big names who are make up that 28 members, corporate members for NVBDC.
Well, let's see. I guess the easiest way for me to do that would be whoever you can think of. But we can start with Apple. You heard that little company called Apple.
Yeah, I heard of that company.
Oh, I got another one called Amazon.
Yeah, you're starting with the A's, yeah.
Let's see. How about this one? AT&T. Let's see. Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, Toyota, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft. Oh, Verizon. Oh, this little one here down here is called Walmart.
Well, I think that gets the point across. That's what I was trying to get to our listeners, okay. Is that the billion-dollar roundtable are these nationally, internationally known businesses who are spending dollars with businesses that are veteran owned businesses, and that's kind of where you guys come, you know, mesh together here. So I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. I appreciate it because, again, you know, the thing that we've always dealt with in the sense of creating the NVBDC, and you would think we'd be past this by now, but I had this exact conversation again this morning with a new corporate member about the skepticism of our veteran businesses. You know, the call that I would get would be, you know, hey, Keith, do you really think these corporations are ever going to hire, you know, a veteran-owned business like me? And the answer is yes. Well, you know, I have been utilizing them for the last couple of years because, frankly, I didn't have a very good yardstick, if you will, in the sense of actual expenditures of our corporate members. And so when I got this report, I actually have what is referred to as the 2022 Billion Dollar Economic Impact Report. And this report goes through and details the amount of money that has been spent with the women, with the minorities, and now with the NVBDC. And just to make the point that I think is not only relevant, but really focuses, you know, the attention on NVBDC, is we are the only accepted veteran certification body by the billion-dollar roundtable, or used by recognized. Their language, they must, the veteran-owned business must be certified by us to be counted in the report of the members of the billion-dollar roundtable. So this is a direct value, direct report in the sense of what these members of the billion-dollar roundtable have spent with NVBDC certified veteran-owned businesses. And the figure I have been using for the last couple of years has been $2 billion. Well, this report came out, and it was really quite startling to us, and obviously we're very proud of the results of this. Because what happened is when this report came out, it shows not only the expenditures, but it actually was specific enough to say Tier 1 spend. So the Tier 1 spend came in at $3.3 billion in 22.
That's just an incredible number, $3.3 billion.
Yeah.
And this is from an economic impact data spend study.
Economic impact report is... I mean, financially, extremely. I know the people who do the audits, and they do not call this an audited report, but they do call it an economic impact report. And the numbers that we are not only very proud of, in the sense of not only their spend with our vets, but they also started breaking down the total, in the sense of the total impact. And here's what they started to do. Or no, it started, that's wrong. What they did, the report says, if you look at these veteran-owned businesses, the veteran-owned businesses' payroll is $2 billion. So not only do our vets hire vets, which we've always said, but obviously they're paying out a lot of good money as well.
Absolutely.
And when we start talking about a $2 billion payroll, well, that's beginning to actually do what we said, that, you know, you get a veteran business the opportunity to grow, to get an opportunity to participate in supplier diversity. They will have an impact not only on the veteran, but their family and their community. So what we're seeing now, and again, this report came out with the gross domestic product, the GDP number was $3.7 billion. And we went, whoa, okay, that means we really are doing the kind of impact in the community that we had been talking about. And then this report shows that the number of jobs by our veteran businesses is 44,498. To use the number. So again, this is just showing you that not only are we talking about a number of businesses, we're talking about jobs. And so what they did is they put it together in a formula, and what they talk about is their total veteran and service disabled veteran impact is $6.7 billion.
Is this an annual number?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
22 alone.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have been mining, if you will. You know, it's like a 90-some page report, and I've read all 90 pages like five times, and I keep going in, you know, in highlighting, because one of the things we're doing, and it's something I you know, have always acknowledged, you know, the women and the minorities as being our mentors and teaching us, you know, how to actually do certification. Numbers, when you look at the minority numbers and the women numbers, three, four, five times our numbers. And that's fine. They, I mean, we've been doing this roughly, you know, nine going on 10 years, and they've been doing it 50 for the minority and 25 years for the women. So they got a pretty good jump on us, but what we're now doing, and as part of one of the reasons I want to make sure all the veterans who are listening understand, what we're also now doing is going back to the minorities, back to the women, and say, hey, wait a minute, how many minorities, you know, certified minorities, how many certified women are veterans? And to take a look at that and say, hey, do you have, or if you don't, you should have both certifications. Or more important to me, I guess, and more important to the individual, is what we call our triple threat. That would be primarily, you know, a female minority veteran who can get all three of our certifications. Because what we talk about is expanding the pie. Well, if we look at this, they being the corporations, may say, you know, I'm pretty good in my minority spend, I'm pretty good in my women's spend, but hey, you know what, I got this veteran who I know, you know, as a minority, we'll count that as a veteran spend. So, you know, when we start looking at the scope, that's what I'm really getting at. You start looking at the scope. I used to say, hey, you know, from our informal report, we're at around $2 billion, a little over $2 billion. But now that I have an actual economic impact study, and by the billion-dollar roundtable, this is no longer Keith or the NVBDC. This is the members of the billion-dollar roundtable come out and said, hey, the spend with veteran businesses certified by the NVBDC is $3.3 billion, and the total impact in the market is $6.7 billion.
Annually. I mean, it's a, you know, yeah, you got to keep reminding, these are big numbers, yeah, for most of us will never comprehend these kind of numbers. And I think as we've been in partnership between Veterans Radio and NVBDC over time, we've been able to talk to so many of your members who talk up the, hey, I have a personal experience. Let me tell you about the added value that my company got by being certified. And this just proves up, you don't have to do it anecdotally, this proves up that being certified by NVBDC adds value and opportunity to your business. And I, you know, this really moves it to a whole nother level, doesn't it, Keith?
It does, Jim, and thank you for that.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Walter Ehlers and his brother were in the first wave to hit Omaha Beach on D-Day. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Staff Sergeant Ehlers' brother was several hundred yards away on the beach, and they didn't see each other. Ehlers' unit ran into a decimated unit of Bangalore torpedo men and provided cover for them as they used their explosives to blow a hole in the German fortifications. This allowed an American breakout. On June 9th, Ehlers' platoon came under heavy fire. He climbed a hedgerow and called his men to follow. He spotted a German patrol and killed four of the enemy. Ordering his men to fix bayonets and firing from his hip, he destroyed a machine gun nest. He then attacked a second machine gun, killing three more. The platoon moved out the next morning and came under intense fire from both sides. The commander ordered a withdrawal. Ehlers realized that someone had to provide cover. He motioned his automatic rifleman to follow him, scrambled to the top of a mound of earth that provided a vantage point. They began firing on the Germans, drawing fire away from the rest of the platoon. Ehlers was hit in the back, but was able to kill the sniper that shot him. When his rifleman was wounded, Ehlers dragged him to safety. Ehlers was treated at a field station and insisted on returning to action. Unable to strap on a backpack, he strapped on two bandoliers of ammunition, picked up a rifle, and went to find his men. A month later, he was informed that his brother was killed on Omaha Beach. Ehlers was presented the Medal of Honor by Lieutenant General John Lee on December 19, 1944.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Hey, Len Lamel, who is a survivor of Normandy, climbed up the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc, blew up artillery, all kinds of things. And I wanted to just give you a little background on our guest. Len, or sometimes better known as Bud, graduated from Point Pleasant High School in 1937, Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Mr. Lamel, I want to welcome you very much to Veterans Radio. I want you to tell us a little bit about your experience on that morning of D-Day in 1944.
Now you want me to?
Now, yeah, it's your turn.
You don't want me to answer any questions, just that. Tell you about D-Day.
We'll have questions as we go along. All right, I'll start off with. You started coming in on the boats at the bottom of Pointe du Hoc. You've got a 10-meter wide beach that really isn't a beach.
That's true. Not a beach, not in the sense of beach sand. It was stones, round stones, called shingles. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the so-called beach was very narrow at the foot of Pointe du Hoc, which are cliffs 100 feet tall, straight up. And we landed there D-Day morning. Supposedly, we're going to be there by 6:30. But we came off a channel steamer. You know, a channel steamer is a boat with cabins and everything on it. It goes from England to France and from France to England just across the English Channel. But that was our transport of the Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really deluxe that we had rooms to ourselves, a couple guys to a room. We didn't expect such tender loving care, but it was enjoyable. Anyway, it was manned by British seamen, British Navy men,
mm-hmm.
and they were the coxswains on our landing craft, and we were supposed to land at 6:30. However, the lead coxswain was lost. He was heading for the wrong point.
Mm.
He was. There are many points along the Omaha Beach areas, about 7 miles in width. And only one-third of it is a sandy beach where the troops landed on the sandy portion. The other two-thirds are cliffs all the way up to over 100 feet
mm-hmm.
as you proceed westwardly. So our commanding officer, he wasn't a general then, Colonel Rutter, mm-hmm. noticed this fact that we were seemingly headed for the wrong cliffs. And so he corrected the coxswain had them pull to the right and parallel the cliffs for several miles till we got up to Point de Hoc, which was several miles beyond the actual sandy beaches of Omaha Beach.
And all during that time, the Germans, of course, are shooting at you, I'm assuming.
No, yes, but had we been on time, we'd have caught them in their quarters. This is a big fortress with underground railway, underground tunnels and things, and sleeping quarters, and where the German troops lived. But anyway, we would have caught them in their bed, and it would have been much easier. But because we were late by 30, 40 minutes, they were aroused by all the noise and shooting because they didn't expect anybody to come up those cliffs. They had no defenses against that. They didn't think anybody was crazy enough to climb those 100-foot cliffs straight up. So their defenses were aimed in a different direction. But they came out and found that we were there, and so they kept shooting us off the ropes and shooting us down from the cliff tops, rolling boulders down and dropping grenades on us and doing everything they could to keep us from getting up there. However, we were very fortunate. We landed with 225 Rangers, and 180 of us got up the cliffs, very quick time, managed to fight our way across the top of the point to where the big guns were supposed to be.
And what did you find when you found the supposed big guns?
I didn't find the guns were not where they were supposed to be. They were where our Army intelligence said they were, in these gigantic encasements. But when we got there, there was telephone poles sticking out of these encasements. And, you know, we had studied Point de Hoc from aerial photographs. Mm-hmm. And from the aerial photographs, they look like the barrel of a gun sticking out a big howitzer or a ghost of a gun. But when we got to our gun positions we had been assigned to destroy them, and we found they weren't there, we figured, well, we'll fight our way inland because we had other parts of the mission. The second part of the mission was to, when you get out to the coast road, that's about a mile inland, which is a coastal road between important sites. And we were to put up a roadblock to prevent the Germans from getting through to Utah Beach. And we then had to destroy all their communications along that highway, which we did. And when we got there, I landed with 22 men in my LCA, manned by British sailors. The 22 Rangers with me, by the time we fought our way through the Germans inland, I only had 12 left when I got to the road a mile inland. Approximately. And while there, I told 10 of them, the section sergeants, to create a roadblock there while I asked one of the staff sergeants, my acting platoon sergeant. You see, we were in an acting capacity. Mm-hmm. I was an acting platoon leader, which is a position of a lieutenant. Jack Kuhn, my staff sergeant, he was acting in the role of a platoon sergeant, which is a tech sergeant. And so the 10 men that I left created the roadblock and took care of the communications, as was the second part of our mission, while Sergeant Kuhn, Jack Kuhn, and I went looking for some evidence of where the guns could probably or might be. We thought we'd hear them. Well, we didn't hear them. So we just had one choice, and people think we're heroes. I don't think we were at the right place at the right time. And lucked out. We went down this sunken road between high hedgerows that are 9-10 feet high with trees 60 feet high out of the top of them. You could hide a whole column of tanks down this road because in back of those cliffs, the land dips down into the lowlands and flooded areas. So we leapfrogged down that road guarding each other. There's only two of us. We went beyond two lines of German defenses. It's 8 o'clock, before 8 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't dream that there'd be a couple American soldiers a mile or two inland or whatever it was, and so they didn't know we were there.
And Bob, you had a question for our guest.
Len, how are you this evening?
Fine, thank you.
Now, when you got to the top and you found that the guns weren't there, you actually had part of your mission accomplished. So to go inland and not just set up a
perimeter there took a bit of initiative. Was that part of your training to take the initiative rather than take a defensive position?
We take charge. Our motto is to be the best of the best. We're all volunteers. But in any event, we went down that road and found the guns. They were very, very well camouflaged in an apple orchard. And they were at the ready with their ammunition all ready to be fired. But they weren't being fired for a reason. They weren't getting fire orders back from their observation point out on the cliffs of Point de Hoc, which was surrounded by E Company of our Ranger Battalion, and they had them bottled up that they couldn't get fire orders back to where Jack Kuhn, Sergeant Kuhn and I were. And so about 100 yards from us was 75 Germans. This is now 7:30, quarter to 8 in the morning, and they're off in this field getting, at that time of the day, they were just getting up and coming in the various states of undress to this meeting they were having, and we were already behind the second line of defense. They didn't know we were there. So while they were busy engaged doing what they had to do, waiting for fire orders, and there was no one in the position, I asked Jack to get up on the high hedgerow there with his submachine gun and protect me as I would go into that gun position alone by myself and knock out as many guns as I could. Well, you know, having to climb those cliffs, we could only carry one incendiary grenade apiece, and we had to travel light so we could muscle ourselves up those cliffs. So he had one. He gave me his semi-grenade, and I had one. And so I went in, and I destroyed a traversing mechanism and elevation mechanisms with the thermite grenades of two of the guns over five that were there. And I broke the sights on all of them by wrapping my field jacket around my butt of my submachine gun and smashing them. And none of this could be heard because of the manner in which we were trained to do these things. So then Jack and I decided we would run back just 100 yards to where our roadblock was and get as many grenades as we could carry back to come back and finish off the job. Well, it took about 10 minutes at most. And we came back and destroyed the other three, so all five were put out of action by 8 a.m. Now, that's early in the morning. And they contended that we were made the deepest penetration on D-Day morning. We were the first military outfit to accomplish its mission and finish it. We did it all by 8 o'clock in the morning, which, when you put out that kind of coastal gun positions, the biggest on the Atlantic coast, they said that we saved thousands, tens of thousands of lives on the beaches and on the ships. There's 5,000 ships out there moored, you know, with an invading force. And this is why the planners of the invasion were really so keyed up about having some way to ensure and guarantee those guns would be out of position, because there were hundreds and hundreds of planes that bombed it. There were thousands of shells from the two battleships of Texas and the Arkansas, and they all missed the targets. None of them destroyed any of the guns, and if it wasn't for us, the Rangers getting up those cliffs, finding them and destroying them, put them out of action, they would have been firing away uncontrollably, killing so many civilians and service people that they said was in the thousands. So that's why it was so important. But again, I say, we were trained to do these things, and
that was,
it'd be resourceful, yeah, and think and on our feet. We were lucky at the right time.
That was your job. And those guns had a range of, what was it, 25,000 meters? They could have taken out all of the ships
miles.
On
ice. Yeah. Fire 12 miles.
I think it's amazing. I should also point out to our listening audience that, I don't know, do you want to be called sergeant or lieutenant? Or just mister?
Pardon?
Anyway, that you had been wounded on the initial assault.
Yes, I was the first one wounded in my company.
And you did all this while you were wounded?
I did it all with the wound. Listen, I got luck out again. I caught a machine gun bullet through my right side where the muscle is. It didn't hit the hip joint.
No, it didn't hit anything important, right?
So I could handle it.
As a result of your knocking out that artillery battery, you and Sergeant Kuhn were received medals for that.
Oh, yes.
And you got the Distinguished Service Cross, and
yes, I did.
Sergeant Kuhn got the Silver Star. I think that's incredible.
Yes, he did. He became chief of police of Altoona, Pennsylvania. He died here about a year or so ago.
Isn't it amazing when you look back at what you did when you were, what, 19, 20 years old?
22. I was 22. He may have been a little younger. I doubt it.
I think that the whole story is just amazing, and I congratulate you and thank you for what you did to our service, to our country, and for our country at that time.
It happens, by the way, D-Day happens to be my 60th wedding anniversary.
That is very true.
A veteran, Veterans Radio salute to you and your wife.
Well,
what is her name?
Charlotte.
And I understand in reading your biography that she climbed Ponta Hawk also.
When we were 40 years old, I was in Parris Sound legal business.
That's right. And we're talking with Len Lamel of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, who was responsible for knocking out the artillery battery that was located on top of Ponta Hawk, climbing up a 100-foot cliff, finding the guns weren't there, went down the hedgerow, found the guns, threw some grenades in there, melt them down, went back and got more grenades.
Right.
What were the Germans doing? Were they watching you run around, or they just never saw you?
No. What were the Germans doing that we saw?
Yes.
They were gathering together in this field about 100 yards away. They didn't know there was any American soldiers that close to them. They never dreamed that we were in among them.
Couldn't they?
40 or 50 of a combat patrol of the Germans passed within 20 feet of Jack and I. There's only two of us, and we hid behind in a ditch behind a hedgerow. And fortunately for us, they didn't see us to detect us, or we'd have been dead. You have to have a lot of luck.
Oh no, I understand. Surviving conflict is always a matter of a lot of luck, but it's just amazing that you took the initiative to not only complete your mission, but to carry it all the way through with a lot of your buddies and commanders and everything falling by the wayside. I think that's just admirable, and it's something that American military has a history of doing that, and I think we all should be very proud of that.
Oh well, we're very proud. We're very well trained, and if you're at the right place at the right time and you're trained to do something, you do it.
Well, I don't mean to gush on here, but I really do admire it. I want to have you back on our program at some point, because I'd like to talk to you more about what happened once, post D-Day, because I know that you were evacuated 2 days after D-Day to get that minor wound taken care of.
Yeah, my side had turned black from gangrene.
You're just amazing. Well, I want to thank you, General Kaczynski, for being on Veterans Radio, and Len. Len Lamel, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. It's a great story, and there's much more to it, and we're going to have you back again to talk about this.
Well, Ranger.
More.
Let's do a Ranger story.
I'm very proud to be on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you very much.
You're the general for me.
I will.
Thanks, Len.
Okay.
Thank you both very much, and we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Every once in a while, folks, we run into these incredible guests, and Bob found this because we were reading the information on Ponta Hawk, and we came across Stephen Ambrose's book, and he's talking about Len Lamel as being the one man who went up the cliff and blew up these artillery weapons, and then thanks to the general and to another old friend of ours, Charles Crone. Thank you very much, Charles. We do appreciate your help. We were able to get a hold of Len and talk to him personally. I just think that's amazing. What a story. And again, if it hadn't been for D-Day and for all those men and our fathers and grandfathers and so forth that fought in World War II, we wouldn't be here talking about them. And I want to make sure that we thank
them.
It's
such an American story, too.
It is.
I mean, it's an American story. The humility and bravery and just going on, pressing on.
Well, taking the initiative is always something that
and you didn't
the American
know what
military
was ahead. You didn't
no.
know what was ahead.
No, there, because as soon as everything was wrong. Okay, I just wanted to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. Remember, D-Day, June 1944, was the largest invasion in the history of the world. You heard about it on Veterans Radio. And until next week, you are dismissed. God bless America.
mountain, to the prairie, to the ocean, white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountain to the prairie.